Our next speaker is David Salzberg. David is a retired statistician from Pfizer. David spoke to our book club about his book entitled The Lady Tasting Tea. He has a new book out called Errors, Blunders, and Lies and How to Tell the Difference. Go ahead, David.
Thank you, Larry. A pandemic is raging. Patients arrive in the emergency room barely able to breathe, their blood oxygen levels plunging. In spite of the best efforts of the medical staff, the death rate is running above 6%. Suppose one of the MDs recalls that there is a peculiar pharmacological effect of drug X that might be useful here. How could we determine if drug X is useful? Well, the gold standard for finding out if a drug X works is two or more double-blind, randomized clinical trials of adequate size. But it will take months to develop a proper protocol and to identify appropriate patient characteristics, and even longer to recruit the hundreds of patients who would be needed to get adequate statistical power. Patients are dying now. Isn't there something other than the gold standard? Is there a silver standard? Is there a lead standard? Is there even a wooden standard? In 1952, William Cochrane, the chairman of the statistics department at Johns Hopkins, faced a similar situation. The Baltimore Housing Authority was about to open a new block of subsidized housing, but it had been noticed that many families broke up soon after moving from their old slum dwelling into new housing. The Housing Authority had developed a method for measuring family cohesiveness. They came to Cochrane and asked if they could use that measurement to determine if moving into new housing decreased family cohesiveness. They could not assign new homes at random, though, because they had promised that the homes would be rented out on a first-come, first-served basis. If they did that, however, the families that moved into new housing would tend to be more aggressive and have more incentive than those who were signed up late or not at all, and they would not be comparable. Cochrane suggested what he called an observational study. Pick a group of families that were moved and a group that were not, and measure the change in family cohesiveness. Then, using statistical regression, develop a formula that predicts changes in that measure using all the baseline data they have on each family, except whether the family moved or not. Predict the change expected based upon these baseline characteristics for each family, and look at the difference between the predicted and the observed change in cohesiveness in each family, and see if that difference differs between the two groups. He called this an observational study. The phrase observational study has been badly misused in the medical literature and is often used to describe nothing more than the usual collection of case histories. But when Cochrane's method has been properly applied in medicine, it has produced some very useful results. In spite of the misuse in medical journals, the observational study has been effectively used in many fields. A new journal entitled Observational Studies, and begun in 2015, has provided examples of its use in sociology, economics, epidemiology, and other fields. Cochrane's approach to observational studies has been used to examine the value of seatbelts in automobiles, the relationship between smoking and health, the dangers associated with the anesthetic agent halothane, and the effects of chewing on coca leaves among Indians in Peru. As far as the COVID virus is concerned, preliminary results of the VA study released last week seems to show that more patients died when treated with a chloroquine drug than those who were untreated. But we don't know if the patients who were treated with the drug were more seriously ill to begin with, or how they might differ in other essential ways. Cochrane has shown us that even in the midst of a raging pandemic, careful, scientifically useful studies can be mounted. Running a properly randomized study, complete with appropriate patient consent, requires more than just the random assignment of patients. It takes a staff well-trained in running double-blind studies. You cannot depend upon untrained interns or nurses or medical students to take care of the details. However, if all you need to run a Cochrane observational study is the adequate collection of baseline values, most of which will be collected on the patient record in the normal course of medical practice. It may take a little statistical manipulation to identify those baseline variables that are most predictive of outcome, and there will always be somebody in academia who will point out that some tit was not followed by the appropriate tittle. but at least we know if the peculiar pharmacological aspects of drug X should be followed up. And you had some questions for me.
David, I guess I'll ask one. I guess what I think you're saying is, what Cochrane's methods would be, is that when two patients come in that are of similar age, morbidity, and level of what's called virus sickness, that you split those two into called control, you know, A and B, or A and not A. And then because we're throwing the kitchen sink at these people in terms of a variety of treatments at the same time, you now have A and not A, and then you can vary randomly the other treatments, B and C, as well. And that from that, you can then tease the covariances and better understand whether A or not A works. Is that the essence of what Cochrane is suggesting?
That's sort of the way, except he's not suggesting that you manipulate it at all. You don't intervene on the basis of trying to get a balance. You simply allow the physicians to follow their best medical judgment. And then when it's over with, or when you finally get mortality values out of these, you look and see what characteristics the patient brought in were predictive of death or of survival. It's the point is of Cochrane's lean is you don't attempt to assign things at random, but you just take things as they came and then adjust them. Donald Rubin up at Harvard developed a Bayesian interpretation of this, in which he said, you have two patients, one treated with A, one treated with B. Each patient has a potential response to both A and B. So you put into your formulas a dummy variable for the patient's A's response to B and patient B's response to A. And then you throw in some Bayesian priors and you work out the appropriate distribution of the best estimate of the probabilities. So it's been a fairly highly developed procedure with a lot of mathematics.
Okay, Dave, I'll come back to you in the Q&A.